On this week's prequel episode, we follow up on our predestination listener polls and preview Snow White and the Huntsman. Hello, and welcome back to another prequel episode of This Film is Late, the podcast where we talk about movies that are based on books. It's a prequel episode. Plenty to get to. No need to mess around. We'll start, as always, like we do, with our patron shoutouts.
I put up with you because your father and mother were our finest patrons, that's why.
One new free patron this week, N. I think I pronounced that right. It's spelled A-N-N-E, like Anne, but yeah. It has an umlaut over the A. And I looked it up, and it says that's pronounced like an E sound, kind of, in English.
Yeah, like an E.
Like an E. So N, I believe, would be the way you would pronounce that, as opposed to Anne, as we would in America. So Anne, or sorry, N.
N. immediately
messed it up. Thank you for joining over at the free tier. Again, you just get access to the polls and all that kind of stuff if you sign up for free. But yeah, you can do that, and that's another good way to follow us if you don't utilize traditional social media. As always, we would like to thank our Academy Award-winning patrons, and they are Amanda, Nicole Goble, Harpo Rat, Nathan, Matilde, Cottonwood Steve, Ben Wilcox, Teresa Schwartz, Ian from Wine Country, Kelly Napier, Gratch, Just Gratch, Shelby Will Return in Avengers Doomsday, and That Darn Skag. Thank you all very much for your continued support. We could not appreciate it more. Katie, it's time to see what the people had to say about predestination.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
All right, well, we had quite a few comments on Patreon.
Yes.
I'm going to do the best I can because my throat's still a little... Yeah. I'm still coughing a bit more than you
That's true, yeah. I can read them if you want.
We might need to take turns or something.
If you want me to take, I can absolutely read them. I'm in better shape than you are.
So on Patreon, we had 4 votes for the book and... No, wait, I have that the other way around. We had 4 votes for the movie and 2 for the book.
Really?
No.
No, I think that's
right. I have
right.
that the other yes. way around again. We had 4 votes for the book and 2 for the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know why I looked at that and doubted what I wrote, but I did. Our first comment was from Nathan, who said, I really didn't have any fondness for either version, so I will default to the written word and thus the short story. It is, as you all said, just a writing exercise, and not a particularly interesting one at that. I'm honestly confused that if they weren't really going to deal with transgender themes, why they bothered adapting it at all. Also, I would expect a movie called Predestination to have an example where someone tried to thwart destiny and failed, but in this movie, it's mostly people deciding to not even try. Ethan Hawke travels once to stop the Fizzler and then accepts defeat. Also, time can be changed in this world, as shown by the Fizzlers saving lives or by the very existence of Robertson's organization, but not in this case. I think the idea that John/Jane/Ethan Hawke/Fizzler is too important to erase, but the fact that it's possible to do so means we don't have predestination in a movie called Predestination.
I think in their instance, what the movie might be implying is that it is, because there's this whole kind of thing they talk about, or Robinson talks about, or Robertson, or whatever his name is, mentions about how they are one of the very few, like, I can't remember the words he uses to describe it, but that mm-hmm. they are kind of, because of the weird nature of John/Jane's existence, they're like a closed loop.
Like so, a fixed point.
Like essentially because they have no connections to any other.
Right.
Their existence is completely self-contained.
Yeah.
The point is that I think their fate is not. It is predetermined, like is predestined, or like I think that's what the movie's implying, is that the weird cyclical, like again, self-contained nature of John/Jane's existence makes their fate predetermined because there are no outside forces essentially acting on it, kind mm-hmm. of, I think is the idea. Basically, and it's also why they are a Time Bureau agent, is that because they are so Robinson, and I can't, it's been so long since we watched the movie that I cannot recall. He has some line about how they're one of the few people who can actually like do this Time Bureau work because of the fact that they have no entanglement with
right.
any other people or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like I vaguely remember what
it's,
you're talking
I think it's
about.
An exchange while they're at the hospital, like when he shows up and like right before Ethan Hawke like steals yeah. the baby. They him and Robinson like have a conversation, I think, at the hospital. And I think during that conversation, Robertson or whatever has some line about the fact that Ethan Hawke's character, John Jane, is like a closed loop, mm-hmm. makes them valuable because they can then do this time travel thing and interact with other people without it being messy because they are like a closed loop. I don't know if it makes any sense, but I swear the movie talks about that. And again, it's been so long that I don't recall the specifics of it. But I think that's the idea, is that they can affect events, other events outside of their timeline, but within their timeline, they have there's this perfectly stable, self-fulfilling paradox mm-hmm. that makes it impossible for them to affect their own timeline, but they can affect stuff outside of their timeline. And as to why we would adapt it, you know, if you're not going to really address the transgender themes at all, I think it's because it is a fun magic trick. And I can imagine, like I said, I can imagine a younger version of myself finding this movie very fascinating and being the kind of movie I would want to make back when I was like in college.
Yeah,
because I was much more interested in like the clever spectacle of film as opposed to kind of themes and stuff like that mm-hmm. wasn't as important to me when I was watching movies then. Like I wrote, like my thesis project is like a riff on it was very clearly like a ripoff in a way, like a bad ripoff of oh my god, the Christopher Nolan movie Memento
mm-hmm.
kind of like, and mine is like a similarly like out of order. It's not a time traveler movie,
yeah,
but it is like the narrative's out of order in a way that kind of similar to how Memento does it. And that sort of like physical structure of the film I thought was really interesting, and like puzzling out how you put that together
mm-hmm.
was I think is still interesting. It's just not the most interesting thing to me about movie, but it used to be like the most interesting thing to me about movies. And so I think that's why you make a movie like this, even if you don't care about exploring like some of the yeah, specific yeah. central themes.
No, I agree. I could see a younger version of I probably wouldn't have watched this movie as right. a younger version of myself, but I could see a younger version of myself where I like watched it and was like, oh my god, that's so cool.
That's clever. Such a yeah, cool such idea. A brilliant idea. Like, yeah.
And, you know, similar to like the first time you really encounter non-linear storytelling yeah. or something like yeah. that, where you just like are blown away by the yeah. concept of
it. Which I had a similar experience, although I still identified a lot with the themes of it, but like I had a similar experience watch or reading of Cloud Atlas earlier
yeah.
this year, of like that very unique structure of it, which apparently is just how Frankenstein is written, but at least it's similar. But like that structure was like, and like the magic trick of it was very cool. And now I also liked other things in it, like thematically and narratively mm-hmm. and stuff, but I was really drawn to kind of the magic trick of the structure and the practical nature of like how it was written, as opposed to just like what it's saying. I am gonna take over because Katie's struggling. Next up, we have a comment from Shelby. A nice little short comment here that says, the short story was fun, but like you said, I'd much rather see a trans person's take on the idea. Just listening to your discussion, the movie sounds overcomplicated and the bomber element. I love that I already knew the song I Am My Own Grandpa from social media, so I could appreciate the reference the way it was intended. I don't think the movie's overcomplicated. I think the movie's pretty, like, it's definitely a, you're like confused for most of it.
Yeah.
Until the reveal, and then you're like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I didn't really care for the fizzle bomber element. Not because I thought it was overcomplicated, but I didn't feel like it all fit together quite as well as the movie wanted it to.
I thought it worked pretty well. I think, like, structurally, like, narratively, the film actually works pretty well, and it's pretty, like, tight in terms of how it all fits together. And I even like thought the fizzle bomber plot was fine. I like the way it works in the reconstructive surgery and all that sort of stuff. It just, like, I think that all works well. It's just my issue is that that's all that works in the
yeah.
movie. Like, that's the main thing that works in the movie. It's just lacking like the heart, like the more interesting thematic character stuff. or at least it doesn't have enough of a focus on the thematic character stuff for me to like genuinely like it as a movie. But I didn't think it was overcomplicated. Again, it's confusing as you're watching it, but it does become less confusing as things are revealed, and then you get that kind of magic trick reveal at the end. But next up, we have a comment from Kelly Napier. I enjoyed the movie and I enjoyed the short story, but I ended up picking the story over the movie because the Fizzle Bomber plotline felt like a device to help string a 10-page story into a 90-minute movie. I preferred how the story just focused on John/Jane's past paradox instead of also trying to insert a John/Jane future paradox as well. I also like the fact that the story didn't flesh out John/Jane's backstory a whole lot. My whole family watched the movie with me, and I found it really interesting to see them discover the twist that I knew was coming the whole time. We were talking about it afterwards, and I had a completely different experience with the movie than they did, since I knew. But I guess that's the whole point of what you all are doing with the podcast. Yeah, that is literally the point of what we're doing. It's definitely a movie that I think I was talking to my coworker who had seen the movie, and he said he enjoys watching this movie with, or maybe it was a comment. I might be confusing that conversation with a comment I read somewhere on the internet, but people talking about how they enjoy watching this movie with people for the first time, just for the weird magic trick reveal.
Yeah.
It,
yeah. You know? I mean, that would be a fun one to watch with somebody who didn't know what was coming.
No idea. Yeah. Cause I think the magic trick is effective. Next up, we have a comment from Eric, who says, I'd never heard of this movie or story, and I was delighted to find a 50s trans/intersex sci-fi story. I'm trans and mostly read pre-Stonewall queer literature, so this was right up my alley. The movie, not so much. The born in the wrong body phrasing is very of its time and still something some people resonate with, but I've never vibed with it. Also had no time for the gender essentialist trans men are naturally more aggressive /stronger/ not like other girls, and really wish they had cast a trans man or a cis man instead of a cis woman for the part. I definitely have more of a soft spot for a writer hearing about trans women like Christine Jorgensen and excitedly writing a time travel paradox story involving a trans person than a 2010s movie that really didn't go much further than the trans aspect, despite the decades and having so much more time in a movie runtime. The short story gets my vote. Yeah.
I think that's totally fair.
Think that all makes sense. And yeah, I'm aware. I think I alluded to that in the episode. I'm aware that the like born in the wrong body phrasing is some trans people identify with that and some people don't. And it's like a very mixed bag in terms of like, how that kind of idea, how accurate of a representation of trans experience that is. And it varies very greatly. But I think that that's true across the spectrum, like with everything. It's just everybody's trans experience is very unique. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shared similarities, but it is very different from person to person. And again, this one is particularly unique because of the nature of the forcedness of it and among other things. So,
and the time travel paradox
and the time travel stuff. Yeah, that adds an extra layer. Next up, we have a comment from Cottonwood Steve. My infinite hate for Amazon really got me into trouble with this story. I tried using thrift books in hope of finding a physical copy of this story in one of Heinlein's collections. That's what you did, right? You found a copy of it in a collection. But after two attempts, I gave up. I give the movie the thumbs up by default. Predestined, it's funny, I think you could almost find this, like, it's so short, I feel like you could just find it on the internet.
I didn't look. I imagine you maybe
you
know,
like
could.
A PDF or, you know what I mean?
I didn't even look for it.
It strikes me as something that
it
wouldn't be that hard to find.
Steve, if you want my copy, I'll mail it to you.
There you go.
DM us.
Predestination is not a bad film, but being a connoisseur of the time travel genre, it's pretty much in the middle for me. Yes, just imagine me sipping latte with my pinky finger up while saying that. Not as interesting as Primer, Time Crimes, or even Tenet. I did like the weird retrofuturism that was brought to the screen. The Spierig brothers always bring something a little different to the genre they take on, whether it was the deadpan humor of Undead or the idea of Daybreakers being an indictment of the American healthcare system through the lens of the entire world having vampirism, and rather than curing the disease, they are trying to placate with a fake blood substitute. I know nothing about Daybreakers other than Ethan Hawke is in it. Now, I am not a person to speak on trans representation, but upon first view, it was not something I really felt strongly about. Upon rewatch, I do realize there were some things that they could have done better, but all the criticism seems to have been spelled out pretty succinctly. Since it was a little problematic, the film will be somewhat forgotten unless someone like the pop culture detective, provided he actually still produces content, takes a whack at the subject. I actually don't think its problematic nature is why it will be forgotten. I think it's forgetting. It's
kind of mid.
Kind of midness is why it will be forgotten. I think it were it a better film, like a more interesting, complex, like thematically resonant film, I think it would be remembered more. I think it's a perfectly adequate time travel sci-fi that does a really good magic trick, but it's just, it's not, there's not a lot more to it than that. And I don't think it's not masterful in the way of something like Tenet, where it has some cool stuff in it, but Tenet has the whole thing with all the like backwards movement and stuff, and like there's a bunch of really weird stuff in Tenet, and like also by comparison, like Primer is like a very unique style of filmmaking with just like the way the dialogue is written and the very like kind of grimy realistic nature of how it is. This is kind of like Predestination kind of feels like a generic polished studio film that has a little bit more interesting going on plot wise again with the time travel and the way it all works. It's a very well put together polished studio film, but it doesn't really have anything about it that like, other than the magic trick.
Right. And so again, we're back to our the magic trick is really the magic only trick thing.
Is the thing. And I think because of that, it just doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have a super strong directorial voice in like visually or anything like that. And I think that's that more than like anything problematic about it is why it'll be forgotten. Because I've also not seen, you know, if it were really problematic there, I think it would be not forgotten in the other way of like people being like, what the fuck was this movie?
Yeah.
You know, they would be getting called out, or there would be criticism videos about it, about how, or stuff like that. And I don't think it's even gets to that point. And so, yeah, I think the reason it'll be forgotten mostly is just because it's kind of just a pretty okay movie. Overall, no strong feelings for or against the film. Exactly. See, that's why it will be forgotten.
Yeah,
that's the reason. It's different and interesting in several parts, and its aesthetic is something I appreciate. Unfortunately, it's not something you can really rewatch. Yeah. And the aesthetic is fine. I think it looks good. It's just not super interesting.
Yeah, it's not really unique in any
particular way. Some of the like retrofuturism stuff is kind of cool, but it's also not stylistic enough. Like it doesn't push it far enough to really like be its own kind of like, whoa, that's crazy thing. Or you know, and even like the tech stuff doesn't quite push far enough to be super cool. Like some of the weird tech stuff in something like Minority Report. Like that stuff, I think, resonates with people, even though that movie is kind of a polished, it's a Spielberg film, it's kind of a polished, it doesn't have a super distinct visual style. It does more than this movie. But like some of the tech and stuff in that, like the board he uses with his hands where he controls it with, you know, like where he's reading a thing and the little balls rolling down the, all of that stuff feels really like tactile and interesting and unique and makes that movie kind of more memorable. And the little spinny gun and all that stuff. The jetpacks, I think, make something, a movie like that, kind of more memorable than a movie like this. Whereas this movie, again, I like the violin thing, and I like the time travel effect, like what they do, but that's kind of it. Other than that, it's like just people like walking around doing stuff, you know what I mean? Like, and it's not shot particularly interestingly, again, adequately shot well, just not like super memorably or anything like that. So, all right, I think this is our final.
Yeah, this is our last one on Patreon.
Final Patreon comment from Matilde, the very patron who requested this film. I don't remember why I requested this movie in particular. It might have been because I wanted a bit of variety in my list of recommendations. It's one of the very few movies that rely on a plot twist, and that said plot twist didn't disappoint me and actually kind of surprised me. I mean, yeah, it's definitely a plot twist that can work. It's it's well done. That part is definitely well done. Is the book a writing exercise? I think it is. But it accidentally ends up exploring societal and personal themes, albeit briefly, and it's a successful exercise. I think the ending works, and while the logic is contrived, it is also sound. Now, that being said, the short is definitely the product of its time and of an author that doesn't really care about the gender issues he's using. I agree with your opinion on the trans and intersex aspects being plot devices, and the comments you found from the trans Redditor were excellent. I agree with those as well. This is one point where I feel the movie does a much better job. It has to keep those trans and intersex elements to follow the story and explain the paradox, but I feel like the directors are more intentional in the way they make the movie not about that specific experience. It's like they knew it wouldn't be authentic, they didn't want to bite off more than they could chew on the subject, or didn't want to be accidentally offensive or insensitive, so they sidestepped it altogether as gracefully as possible. That's kind of exactly my feeling on it, is that yeah, that kind of sums up what I was trying to say in the episode about, like, when we were talking about that, about, like, I felt like they were trying to be, you know, they didn't want to be offensive or insensitive, so they kind of just do as little as they can to get past it, but it, because it is a integral part of the plot, so you can't just ignore it.
Yeah.
Maybe it would have been a richer movie if told by trans people, but I do agree that there are much better stories suited for the trans perspective than this one. Maybe it's for the best that they didn't force it. They at least offered a sympathetic portrayal of trans and intersex people, and that's a start. Yeah, that's kind of what my feelings were. I give Sarah Snook a lot of credit. I think her acting was very deft and helped make the John and Jane and their transition as real as it could be. In this context and by a cisgender actor, I think they're addressing the idea that, like, ideally, you know, probably we wouldn't have a character that is ultimately a trans man played by a cis woman. But in the context of the film, it's a little complicated by the nature of the film. So, yeah. You feel the confusion and resentment her character feels, and the way she carries herself as Jane and then John is very specific to each and telling. This was the first time I saw Snook in anything, and I'm not surprised she blew up in recent years. She's a quiet powerhouse of an actor. Yeah, I've not watched Succession. She won a bunch of awards for that, obviously, and was very, you know, highly regarded for her performance in that. But I don't think I've ever seen her in anything other than this. Now that I
think
about it.
I've seen her in clips of another movie that I've seen on social media. But that's it.
What movie?
The Dressmaker.
Oh, I'm not.
Has, Kate Winslet in it, I want to say.
Oh.
Also based on a book, so
is
maybe we'll cover
it.
No, I think it's a few years old.
Okay. One point that I enjoyed more than you seem to is that it didn't go very deep into any of the themes and ideas. I actually loved that it planted seeds and then gave you just enough to spark a discussion or a train of thought. I didn't need to have it all defined and explained. I still had endless discussions and thoughts because of this movie. It made me question the concept of personal identity that can be considered narcissism, or what can be considered narcissism, how you can relate to yourself and to your past actions, how we might use the past and other versions of ourselves to excuse our actions, etc. I even appreciate the addition of the Fizzle Bomber being John. I think it brings even more questions about guilt. Personal reform, how we don't really want to change even when presented with the opportunity, how we become more cynical with time, or maybe we just return to the radical ideas of our youth, etc. There's a treasure trove of subjects here, and while most conversations I've had about predestination have started around that big twist, they've never stopped there for me. Okay, that's fair. I can see that. I like those questions are all there. I don't want the movie to like spell it out or give me concrete opinions on those things. It just felt like there was more meat there to even get at that I just wish the movie would have done. I don't know. It just felt like a little too, it just brushed up too gently against the themes. When I would have preferred a sturdier body check or something. What's funny is that I usually hate it when a story isn't mostly about the characters, their emotions, and what emerges from the two, but in this case, I think it's fine that concepts and ideas are basically the whole thing. The short story is a writing exercise. The movie is mostly a structure and genre exercise. Yeah, I completely agree with that. So they're not masterpieces or even well-rounded works, but I take both as food for thought on general psychoanalysis, and that makes them worthwhile in my eyes. Funny enough, you described it as a magic trick that you just watch once, but when I first watched it, I had to take a 10-minute pause to just mull the reveal over in my head, and then I immediately put it on again so I could try and pull it apart. I just couldn't get over that all the characters being one person could actually work and mostly stand on its own. And I still watch the movie once in a while just to tease my brain about the concept of self or just to chuckle at the many hints they drop throughout the movie. I could see rewatching it to catch all of the, because that is definitely like, and we talked about that in the episode, if you can remember some of the lines and stuff from earlier in the film between like Ethan Hawke's character and John at the bar, there's a ton of like, constantly throughout the movie there are a ton of like self-referential kind of meta jokes and stuff about the fact that these are all the same character, which you would not probably catch the first time. So there is rewatchability in that regard. I just think the real punch of the movie, the real like thrust of what makes it good, is that twist. And then after you have that, it loses a lot of its kind of impact. But apparently not for everybody, because you still enjoy kind of going back through it. So, you know, we're all different. Oh, and I picked the movie over the book, partly because I'm incredibly biased towards anything with Ethan Hawke, even if he doesn't particularly shine in this. I thought he was good. I wasn't
blown away by his
because he's not doing anything super crazy in it. Like, there's not anything super, he's not asked a ton of, especially in comparison to like Sarah Snook is asked to do a lot more in this movie than Ethan Hawke is, but also because it's more sensitive and evocative than the short story. I do love the final few lines of the book, though, that they hit the spot pretty well. Thank you for doing another one of my requests. I very much appreciate it. Sorry you had to cover it while being sick. You are both troopers for pushing through. Well, thank you, Matilde. We enjoyed watching it and in talking about it, despite being sick. We had no votes on Facebook, one vote on Instagram for the book and one for the movie. And then finally on Goodreads, we had one vote for the book and zero from the movie. And Miko had this to say. I understand the changes made for the movie. You need a face actor swap if you want to keep the bartender twist hidden for a second. And I can see how from there you'd want to expand the story, creating the fizzle bomber, adding a hint of action, and bringing in a self-contained ending for the character mirroring their beginning. I like the character stuff they added, but dislike the fizzle bomber stuff. I've read the short story and seen the movie before, and I remember that the film's ending fell pretty flat even on the first watch. Even though they are interesting, both the bartender is Jane reveal and the fizzle bomber confrontation just lack the oomph. I liked the fizzle bomber confrontation. The bartender is Jane reveal, again, for me, I just had already figured that out so clearly, like, a long time ago that it was not even a reveal to me at that point. But I actually like the fizzle bomber confrontation, and I like the kind of questions it asked about, like, what Ethan Hawke's character at that point is going to do. And then the way he ends up just, I thought that whole confrontation was kind of fun. I like it. I do think it ends a little abruptly after that. I feel like there need to be a little bit more of a denouement of some sort. I'm not sure what, but I did like that particular scene. And again, I actually like the fizzle bomber plot, but I didn't read the MOOC. So I think the movie is aware how horrible the involuntary transition is. I also think it's not that interested in telling that story while performing its magic trick, but stuff like the doctor casually smoking on the bedside indicates clearly that modern sensibilities do not apply here. It probably also explains the inclusion of the alternate history. They could have moved Jane's timeline up so that the release of the short story aligns with the release of the movie. Jane would have been delivered to an orphanage in 2000, giving birth in 2019, and telling the tale at a bar in 2025. Well, yeah, with the agency being base being in 2048, but due to changed values, that would have been a different movie, and you could not have waved away the involuntary transition. I think it's not that the filmmakers were uninterested in the trans themes, but that they were more interested in the sci-fi magic trick, as Brian said. I agree entirely that and I thought about that while watching the movie, that like the whole part where the doctor, it's like, well, we opened you up and saw and just did whatever.
Yeah.
It's a lot more believable in 1970. And I think we might have mentioned that in the episode. Yeah. I can't remember. I think we may have alluded to that in the episode, but definitely way more believable and like way more of a, you can kind of get away with just using that and not have it feel like a, like pull you out of the movie because you're like, what? Why? No modern doctor would just do, you know, like. Yeah. So it is very much a case of, it works better in the time period than it would today, for sure. There's an interesting wrinkle that the time loop adds. Cladistically, the main character is not human. None of their genetic material is inherited from, well, anyone. I'm wondering how that would affect a more queer-focused version of the story or a queer reading of this. I don't know if that's actually true, because it doesn't make sense, but their genetic material is inherited from themselves.
Yeah.
Which, again, doesn't makes sense because it, but that's the whole point of the time. Like, it's a self-fulfilling, like, it's a self, an Ouroboros time loop. Like,
yeah,
they do have genetic and material inherited from themselves, which, again, it doesn't make any sense. It is impossible, but they do have it. And so, if you grant the time travel premise, they are human because they have genetic material from another human themselves.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I don't know. I'm not entirely. I'm deigned to disagree with Miko on subjects of science fiction, but just because I think he's much smarter than I am. But I don't know if that I buy that, because again, within the time travel conceit of the story, they do have inherited genetic material from a person. Again, it's just a person that they couldn't have inherited time travel or genetic material from, because that's not how it works. But it does work that way in this movie because time travel. A small detail I liked in the movie, the gush of wind that happens when people time jump, is consistently directional, either towards the vacuum jumpers leave behind or outwards when they arrive and displace air. I agree. I liked the special effect of the time travel a lot. In particular, I love the one I liked the most was the scene where he's in the car and then all the windows, he disappears and his hat like falls in the seat and all the windows like suck in and like get from the vacuum. I thought that was I thought this time travel effect very simple, but like very well done. People don't go around intentionally writing classics, but All You Zombies has become the de facto example of a stable time loop in fiction. It has its problems, but in 10 pages, it does what it's going for. The movie includes basically everything from the story, so the question about which is better comes to the added stuff. I like the added characterization of Jane, for Jane. I think the movie does more than the bare minimum with it, but it not that much more. Had the Fizzle Bomber not been part of this movie, I'd easily give it my vote, but now my vote goes to the book. Thank you, Miko. And finally, summing it all up, the short story wins with 6 votes to the movie's 3. Thank you all for your feedback. Really appreciate it. Love talking about what you all have to say about the movies we watch. It's so much fun. But now it's time to preview Snow White.
Do you hear that? It's the sound of battles fought and lives lost. It once pained me to know that I am the cause of such despair. But now, their cries give me strength. Beauty is my power.
Since we're talking about a fairy tale, and if you've been listening to our show for any length of time, you know how I feel about fairy tales. But since we're talking about one, I wanted to start by going back over a few things that we've discussed on the show before. When we talk about fairy tales like Snow White, what we're really talking about is folklore, i.e. stories that come to us via the oral tradition, meaning that they were primarily told aloud and not written down. So a folktale isn't a single definitive story, but rather a trail of stories that stretches across history and cultures that we can now view like in hindsight.
Yes.
And see how those stories developed and what different iterations do and don't have in common. And then I'll get up on my soapbox again. There is no such thing as an original version of a folktale. We can have most well-known or oldest known or first recorded, but not original. So anyone who tells you that there's an original version of a folktale is either misinformed or selling you something.
Yeah. And the reason, just to super clarify, the reason you say that is because they started as an oral tradition, and so we just there is an original version. Like,
if we could jump in a time machine,
get in a time machine
and go back, and everything starts somewhere.
Yes, we could go back and find, if we could somehow pinpoint the first person who told this story.
Yeah,
you could do, you know, it that was a first thing, but that is lost to time. We will never know.
We're never gonna know.
So saying it's the original version, the other thing is they're probably either misinformed or selling you something or using shorthand to say first recorded.
Yes.
Which is, you know, yeah.
Which I would consider misinformed.
Yeah.
But
yes, I think that's fair.
But I like to point that out whenever we talk about a fairy tale, just because there is a lot of misinformation out on the internet, and particularly because older versions of fairy tales tend to be somewhat far removed from like the Disney versions that a lot of us grow up with. You can get a lot of this like kind of sensationalist, like in the original version of this happened. Yes. Isn't that crazy?
Yes, because the fairy tales through Disney have become such a prominent part of culture, and the versions everybody knows are the Disney versions. It's that there's a very popular niche market for fun facts and interesting trivia and stuff about these stories that is rife with simplifications and misunderstandings and all of those sort of things, which is true for everything that gets popular. As soon as you see something gets really popular, you will see kind of the thing pop up as like, actually, did you know that? And usually those did you know are also incorrect in some way, yeah, because they're an oversimplification as a reaction yes. to.
Oversimplification, I think, is probably getting at the heart of it.
Yeah.
You know, if we look at something like Snow White, like you could say like, oh, well, did you know that in the original version of Snow White, the wicked stepmother is forced to dance in hot iron shoes until she dies?
Yeah.
Which is true of the Grimm's version.
Yeah.
But there are also other iterations of the story that don't include that.
Yeah.
So that brings us back around to Snow White. So Snow White is classified as a type 709, also called Snow White, in the Arne-Thompson-Uther Index. Bringing that back.
Yep.
The Arne-Thompson-Uther Index is a catalog of folktale types that's used in folklore studies. And basically what this system does is identify similarities in various stories across cultures and then uses those similarities as a method for categorization. Other variants categorized as type 709 include stories from Italy, Greece, Armenia, Scotland, France, Switzerland, among others. Nothing super duper well known, but the Snow White that we know comes to us via Germany and the brothers Grimm, who first recorded it in 1810. And their version of the story would undergo several revisions until 1854, when they arrived at their own kind of quote-unquote definitive version, which can be found in the 1857 edition of Grimm's Fairy Tales.
Mm-hmm.
And that story was first published in English under the title Snowdrop.
Snowdrop, that's fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is some debate over the possible roots of the German tale specifically that I think is kind of fun, so I wanted to get into that a little bit. So some folklorists believe that Snow White is an amalgamation of other older stories, noting that it contains a combination of motifs present in other tales, such as a child in the woods, a heroine cursed in a deep sleep, and a treacherous mother figure.
Yeah.
Other scholars think that Snow White could have ancient mythical roots, noting its similarities to the Roman legend of Chione, I'm not really sure how exactly.
If it's Latin.
I was looking at the little pronunciation thing on Wikipedia, and it said, like, it was a hard K.
Okay.
But maybe I'm saying it wrong. I don't know.
Well, wouldn't a hard K, Chione and Chione is a hard K in both, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's
Chi or it's Ki.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just thinking maybe Chi, because if it's Roman, it's Latin, and the letter chi, right?
I think it's Greek, though.
Oh, Greek, whatever. Yeah, I don't know. It could be either.
Yeah.
I actually don't know.
But that was recorded in Ovid's Metamorphoses, and Chione or Chione means snow in Greek.
Oh.
And the title character is described as the most beautiful woman in the world. Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
She's also put into a magical slumber by the god Mercury.
Yeah.
And since it's Greco-Roman mythology, you can guess what happens next.
Zeus?
Not Zeus.
Sorry, not Zeus.
Not this time.
Yeah. The other one.
Some other ones.
Yeah.
There are also claims of Snow White being based on an actual historical person. So this is fun. A German historian, I'm about to butcher so many German names in this, just bear with me. German historian Eckhard Sander posits that the character of Snow White was based on the life of Margaretha von Waldeck, a German noblewoman who lived in the early 1500s. However, there are virtually no serious scholars who agree with his theory.
Okay.
And here's an even weirder one. Karl-Heinz Bartels? A pharmacist from Lorraine, Maine in northwestern Bavaria. This is what Wikipedia said, was part of a quote-unquote study group made up of friends who met regularly at a local pub. And apparently they were inspired by a previous hoax that claimed to trace the real life inspirations of Hansel and Gretel. And they then created this tongue-in-cheek theory that Snow White was actually Maria Sophia Margarethe Katharina, a baroness who was born in their town in 1725. Mm. And despite the obviously a joke origins of that, it became popular as a marketing tactic for the town. Be like the town that Snow White is from. Yeah.
Yeah, that's classic.
But whatever the origins, Snow White has been part of the Western cultural consciousness for a long time. Today, people are most likely to recognize Snow White from the 1937 animated film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs from Disney, which was so influential that its popularity has surpassed the Grimm's tale. But like any fairy tale, it can't truly be pinned down to one definitive version. And that's why we're not even talking about Disney's version.
Well, we are on the bonus episode.
We are. Yeah.
Because spoilers, for if you haven't seen the announcement, the winner of the March Madness poll that we will be previewing right now is Snow White and the Huntsman.
Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is fairest of them all?
You are the fairest, but there is another destined to surpass you. Consume her heart and you shall live forever.
Find me someone who doesn't fear the dark forest to hunt her down.
Why is she of such value?
That is none of your concern.
And if I refuse?
They won by 1 point.
1 point. Disney's was the runner-up and will be our bonus episode for March, so look out for that. Movie facts about Snow White and the Huntsman. It is a 2012 film directed by Rupert Sanders in his directorial debut. Also directed the 2017 Ghost in the Shell, the one with Scarlett Johansson playing the like Japanese robot lady. Or I don't know enough about Ghost in the Shell now. I know it was controversial as he was cast in that role. And The Crow remake from 2024, which everybody said was bad. I don't know anything if the Ghost in the Shell movie was any good or not, the remake or the live action version. All I ever heard about it was the controversy. I have no idea. I don't think it was well regarded. So,
yeah,
the film was written by Evan Dougherty, who wrote the 2014 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. He wrote Divergent.
Oh, boy.
The first one. Yeah, was the adapted the first one. Tomb Raider 2018 and The Huntsman Winter's War, the sequel to this film. It was also co-written by John Lee Hancock, who wrote The Blind Side and a film called The Little Things. And finally, Hossein Amini, who wrote Drive, which we've done, 47 Ronin, the terrible film The Snowman. I've not seen it, but it's like a notoriously bad movie. It is an adaptation of a book. The Alienist, and wrote several episodes of the Obi-Wan Kenobi TV show. And this is really funny, wrote Killshot. I had no idea. Killshot was filmed in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, which is where we live. Yeah, it was one of the first big movie, like when Gone Girl was being filmed here. I remember talking to some people and they were people who had worked on Killshot, which filmed here, which I believe the biggest name actor in that, Mickey Rourke, was in that in Killshot. It's not like a huge movie, but and maybe Diane Keaton might be in it. I can't remember, but there's. It was filmed here, and so I just thought that was interesting that he wrote that. Although the primary screenwriter was Evan Dougherty, the other people came on, and we'll talk more about it, but the other people kind of came on just as, like, added little bits and parts to it or whatever. And I don't always mention this, but I had to here after I saw who it was. Cinematography by Greg Fraser, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it. He's Australian, who is the cinematographer for Rogue One, Dune Part 1 and 2, The Batman, The Creator, and Project Hail Mary. Literally our next movie, back to back. But an incredible cinematographer. Like, holy shit. The Batman and the Dune movies, I mean, all of those movies, I haven't seen Project Hail Mary yet, obviously, are incredibly shot. The Creator is one of those that's really interesting because a lot of that was shot on the Sony FX3, which is a camera that I film on occasionally. Like, it's a very, like, mid-level consumer camera. Or like prosumer level camera, and like I think the entire movie was shot on that, now with a lot of very expensive other stuff, but the actual cameras they used were pretty cheap. But yeah, incredible cinematographer. So that maybe that was one of the things that made me like, ooh, okay, I'm interested. This movie was probably going to look good. The film stars Kristen Stewart, Charlize Theron, Chris Hemsworth, Sam Claflin. I always want to say Claflin. Sam Claflin, Ian McShane, Bob Hoskins, Ray Winstone, Nick Frost, and Toby Jones. So a lot of names.
Kind
in
of
this.
A who's who of the era.
Yeah, a lot of names.
Bella Swan, Thor, yep. And Finnick from The Hunger Games.
Yeah, yeah. The film has a 48% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 57 on Metacritic, and a 6.1 out of 10 on IMDb. It was nominated for 2 Oscars for Best Costume Design and Best Visual Effects. And it made $396.6 million against a budget of $170 million, which is why they made a sequel. Did pretty well. So I mentioned earlier that Evan Daugherty was the primary screenwriter, and because he wrote the first draft of this screenplay in 2003 while he was studying at NYU. NYU is one of the most well-regarded film schools in the country. It's probably like them and USC are like the main two. There's other ones, but those are two of the probably biggest filmmaking schools in the country, maybe in the world, probably in that regard. I actually don't know like where they would rank, but gritty reboots of fairy tales weren't really a thing in 2003 when he was writing this, and so according to him, quote, no one really knew what to do with it. Then in 2005, Terry Gilliam made that Brothers Grimm movie that flopped catastrophically, and that caused more hesitancy for anybody to take this script and do anything with it. Until in 2010, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland was a smashing success. And after that happened, they were like, more of this. What do you got that's similar? And that's when Daugherty's script was greenlit. Getting into some very fun casting. Oh, also, this script was, I forgot to write this down, but the script was on the Hollywood blacklist or whatever forever, which is a list of like the best unproduced screenplays. Mm-hmm. Apparently from that, it bounced around for a long time, never finding a home, but everybody was like, this is a great screenplay. Somebody should make it. That's always a fun, and a lot of those screenplays you can find and go read like on the internet. If you ever want to go down a rabbit hole, go look up the Hollywood black, I think it's called the blacklist, because that's also obviously like the idea of being blacklisted, being like,
yeah, I was gonna say that doesn't sound like a good thing.
Yes, but I think it's a play on that, and like these movies aren't being made, but they should be made. Mm-mm. Like that's the idea. But yeah, it was one of those scripts. So producers initially considered a lesser known actress for Snow White instead of Kristen Stewart, but ultimately went with Kristen Stewart. But some of the other actresses that were considered for the role included Riley Keough, Felicity Jones, Bella Heathcote, Alicia Vikander, Lily Collins, who would go on to play Snow White in Mirror Mirror, one of our other competitors.
Came out the same year,
yeah. And Rachel Maxwell. Eventually, there were also rumors around Dakota Fanning and Kristen Stewart. And then finally in March of 2011, Kristen Stewart was confirmed in the role. Another person who was considered for the role of the Evil Queen before it went to Charlize Theron was Winona Ryder, which I think would have been fun. Although I don't think you can beat Charlize Theron for a role like this, to be fair.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not, yeah.
For a role of an extremely beautiful and evil woman, yeah.
Perfect. You nailed it in one. Some other people that were considered for the role of the Huntsman that before Thor eventually landed, Chris Hemsworth eventually got. Other people were considered, this is hilarious, it's just literally like names. So many times with these, I'm like, how serious? Yeah. A lot of these, they say they were offered, I think. All of these were, according to Wikipedia, were offered the role and turned it down. Tom Hardy, Michael Fassbender, Johnny Depp, I assume because the Alice in Wonderland thing, probably. He seems way too old.
Yeah, and not like beefy enough.
No. Viggo Mortensen.
Okay.
And Hugh Jackman.
Okay.
All of them seem too old for the, because Chris Hemsworth was like 25 in this, or not, maybe not 25, but he's like relatively young.
Yeah.
And all the rest of, like, Johnny Depp is like 25 years older than Chris Hemsworth, right? He's gotta be. Johnny Depp's like 60.
I mean, Johnny Depp is pretty old.
Or like 50 something, and Chris Hemsworth is like 35 or something like that.
Age. Well, right now he's 42.
Chris Hemsworth?
Yeah.
Wow, he's older than I thought. Maybe he just looks younger than he was. How old is Johnny Depp?
Let me.
62. So yeah, 20 years.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, those are vastly different
Yeah.
types of actors to play that. I don't know. Like, I can understand Tom Hardy a little bit, like, and Michael Fassbender and Hugh Jackman. Like, I can at least understand all of those being a similar type of actor, kind of, to Chris Hemsworth.
And maybe they might have discussed at one point, and I have seen this movie. I don't remember it very well, but maybe there was a discussion at one point of the Huntsman being more of like a father, at like figure age. To Kristen Stewart. Sure. And I don't think there's any like romantic.
Oh, is there not? I assumed there was.
I think so.
Okay. I know nothing about this movie.
I might
movie,
be
so.
Misremembering that, but I don't think there is.
I just
is.
Assumed if you cast the two sexiest people on the planet at the time, there's the implication. I just, literally just assumed they had a romance like of some sort because it's Chris Hemsworth and Kristen Stewart. I was like, oh, clearly they put them in this movie to like kiss or whatever. But that was an assumption. I know nothing.
I could be misremembering.
I haven't even seen the trailer for
but
this
like,
movie.
But there is a Prince character.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Some other random facts that I thought were kind of fun. The film used academic consultants from the University of Chichester. I'm sure I'm pronouncing Chichester. No, definitely like Chichester or something. And the University of Oxford for the research to back up their research on fairy tales and medieval battles. Mm. So they actually had some consultants to tap in on this. So Rupert Sanders, the director, insisted on realism in scale, and this meant that there was minimal miniature work for the film, or miniature model work for the film. The huge castle in the Enchanted Forest, for example, took 6 months to construct, and there's apparently a gigantic trebuchet at one point consisting of a metal skeleton interior and wooden exterior that weighed 6.5 tons. So they apparently built some very large props and sets for this film. Which is funny because this is literally his director's first movie, and had the pool to be like, it's also $170 million for your first. That's a crazy budget for a guy who had only done shorts before this. Wild. It's like the beginning of that Disney era or like the Marvel era, because they started doing that with like Marvel movies where they would find some. But usually they had made a film, like at least a feature film, just like a small independent feature film, and then they like give them a Marvel movie. With this one, this is his feature film debut, and it's $170 million. It's just wild to me. Charlize Theron tore a stomach muscle while shooting a scene that required her to scream very loudly, according to IMDb trivia, which I thought was fun. This was Bob Hoskins' final film before he announced his retirement and then passed away a few years later. Supposedly during filming, I say that for all of these IMDb trivia facts because I never know how true any of these are. Kristen Stewart accidentally punched Chris Hemsworth in the face and gave him a black eye, and that take is used in the film, according to IMDb trivia. The drops of blood that you see at the beginning of the film are actual drops of real blood from director Rupert Sanders. He felt that the fake blood did not look realistic enough, and so he pricked his finger to get the shot that he wanted.
Literally bled for this
literally
art.
Bled for this movie. Which, based on most movie sets I've been on, that's true of every movie. Or I've not been on movie sets, but film sets or short film sets and stuff I've been on, somebody bleeds every time. So, Charlize Theron said that the hardest thing for her, which I had to include this because I was like, how is this possibly true? This felt like a thing from an interview she said, I don't know. Charlize Theron said that the hardest thing for her was walking in the dress she wore when she married King Magnus. The corset was incredibly uncomfortable. She was almost hunched over by the time she made it to the altar. And I just don't understand how a corset makes you hunch over. Like, I'm trying to figure out what that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know. I would have to see.
That's what I'm saying. I included that specifically so we could look at that scene and try to figure out like what about that.
Like if there was something, like if it was weighted somehow.
Or like the top of it, like.
Yeah,
it would like went really high and was like forcing her back. I'm just trying to figure out what that would mean, because like,
yeah, we're gonna have to watch for that.
Yeah, and it does kind of lean into that kind of like second wave feminine. I don't even know what during of like
the anti-corsetry
bias, the historical idea that like corsets were like horribly constricting and uncomfortable and like a miserable to wear, which again, not entirely untrue in all, because obviously, but is also
they could be very restrictive.
Yes.
And especially if used improperly.
Yes.
But of course it is just an undergarment.
Yes.
It's just a historical bra.
Yeah. And they're not like you've worn corsets before. They are not like wildly uncomfortable. In fact, you sometimes enjoy.
I actually love a corset as a well-endowed person.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of pressure off of my shoulders.
Yeah. I thought this was interesting. It's actually a movie I have not seen, but I wanted to include this anyways. Evan Dougherty cited Hayao Miyazaki's Princess Mononoke as the main reference and inspiration for the film. The white stag that Snow White encounters in Sanctuary is a direct nod to Miyazaki.
Interesting.
I have not seen Princess Mononoke. I have not either. So I can't compare, but I wanted to include
But that's, that is a cool reference point.
And then my final fact that I had to include here, because it just makes me like Charlize Theron even more. Charlize Theron dropped out of J. Edgar to do this movie. J. Edgar is a Leonardo DiCaprio-led film, historical drama about J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI or whatever, written and directed by Clint Eastwood. So, like, it's like a very, like, Oscar Beatty, like, drama thing that, you know, it was kind of like with a very famous, esteemed writer, director, Clint Eastwood, but also fuck Clint Eastwood. And so, like, not saying he doesn't make he's made some good movies or whatever, but like, I love that she was like, nah, fuck that. I'm going to play an evil queen in a Snow White adaptation, like fantasy adventure movie. You know what I mean? I just like I'm glad that there are people making those decisions, because normally you would imagine this going the other way.
Right.
Like, gets cast in like a popcorn blockbuster, like, adventure movie, and goes,
action movie.
Actually, I got cast in this Oscar bait film. I'm going to go do that instead. But no, it was, and maybe it was just for the check. Like, could it have been
maybe.
Like, maybe she had a very small part in J. Edgar and this was a leading role she was going to get paid a bunch of money to do. Could have been as simple as that. But I also just like to think that she was like, maybe I don't want to go be around Clint Eastwood for a few weeks and instead want to go make this movie where I get to chew the scenery as an evil queen.
Yeah.
Getting to some reviews. First up, David Edelston of New York Magazine praised the film's revisionist tone and said that the film was, quote, strongly influenced by a lot of smart feminist thinking, end quote. A.O. Scott of the New York Times praised Theron's performance and also wrote, quote, though it is an ambitious, at times mesmerizing application of the latest cinematic technology, the movie tries to recapture some of the menace of the stories that used to be told to scare children rather than console them, end quote. Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly said, quote, Ravenna.
That's the evil queen.
Yeah,
character.
Ravenna. I just don't know how to pronounce. I'm just Ravenna. We'll see in the movie. Hates living in a world where men can feed on women's beauty and then toss them away. She's a fascist of feminism. And Theron's, that's an interesting choice there, Owen Gleiberman. She's a fascist of feminism, and Theron's acting has the blood of operatic anger coursing through it, end quote. I'm not saying that it's inherently problematic to say that. I'm just saying that, like, I don't know if I would choose that wording for it. But it is,
I mean, he absolutely went with the alliteration.
Yes.
That's why he wrote, he was like, ha-ha.
Yes.
The alliteration.
I just think there's also something kind of inherently, I don't know, like, I'm not saying feminism cannot be fascistic. I don't know if that's impossible, but they are kind of diametrically opposed. Fascism tends to be patriarchal, and I think
there are absolutely, as we well know, in 2026, women who carry water for fascism and for patriarchy.
Yes, but the concept of feminism.
Yes, and I think there are even women who do it while purporting to be like progressive in a sense,
right?
But I don't know that I would call that feminism.
It's just an interesting, I don't know, it's just I think it's more done, it's very it's bombastic, it's attention getting. I get
it's
why
alliterative.
It's alliterative, obviously. So I get it. It's just, I don't know if I would write it that way. That's all I'm saying. Betsy Sharkey of the Los Angeles Times said that the film is, quote, an absolute wonder to watch and creates a warrior princess for the ages. But what this revisionist fairy tale does not give us is a passionate love. Its kisses are as chaste as the snow is white, end quote. Well, there we go. Mm-hmm. But it says there are kisses.
There are kisses.
They're just chaste.
Apparently, Betsy did not think there was enough heat behind it.
Wasn't passionate.
Him, though. It was not,
but somebody's kissing
enough.
Somebody. Rolling Stone's Peter Travers called it, quote, a visual marvel, which makes sense based on the cinematographer, while noting that Stewart, quote, morphs convincingly from a skittish girl into a determined warrior princess, end quote. MSN News said that Stewart, quote, grows into her character, it seems, and eventually got this reviewer completely on her side. Colin Culvert from the Minneapolis Star Tribune gave it 4 out of 4 stars. Richard Ropert, writing for the Chicago Sun-Times, gave the movie a B+, calling it, quote, vastly superior to Mirror Mirror. There we go. And also praised Theron and Stewart's performances. Peter Bradshaw for The Guardian said that the film is, quote, less jokey than the recent Mirror Mirror. This Twilightified fairy tale has the same basic problem, and that, quote, the result is tangled and overblown. So he wasn't a huge fan. Peter Bradshaw is generally pretty negative in his reviews from my memory. Mick LaSalle of the San... This is a who's who of critics. Mm. Like, I've heard of every single one of these critics. Mick LaSalle of the San Francisco Chronicle called it, quote, a slow, boring film that has no charm and is highlighted only by a handful of special effects and Charlize Theron's truly evil queen, end quote. Washington Post's Michael O'Sullivan also gave it a negative review, saying, quote, overlong, overcrowded, overstimulating, and with an over-the-top performance by Charlize Theron as the evil queen Ravenna, the movie is a virtual orchard of toxic excess, starting with the unnecessarily sprawling cast of characters, end quote. Writing for the Denver Post, Lisa Kennedy gave it 2 out of 4 stars, saying, quote, only Bob Hoskins as the blind seer Muir comes close to making us care. We can almost glean Snow White's heroic possibilities through his clouded eyes. As much as we'd like to, we certainly can't from Stewart's efforts, end quote. And Film Comments' Scott Foundas stated, quote, Stewart's Snow White pouts her lips, bats her bedroom eyes, and scarcely seems to have more on her mind than who might take her to the senior prom, let alone the destiny of an entire kingdom, end quote. I bet that's some sexist bullshit.
Oh, yeah, that absolutely.
That reads as deeply sexist bullshit.
And I don't know if you probably don't recall any of the, like, but I remember when Kristen Stewart got announced as Snow White.
I don't remember the reaction,
movie.
But I remember the internet's general feeling about Kristen Stewart at the time.
And it was brutal.
Yeah, I can
there
imagine.
There were a lot of jokes about how she could not possibly play the fairest person in the land. Like, Kristen Stewart's ugly.
I will fight. Kristen Stewart is a perfectly good, sometimes very good actress. I do not understand people who are, even in Twilight, she's not bad.
But this is like squarely in the Twilight years, and everybody hated Kristen Stewart. Yeah. And I think this came like right on the heels of, she had an affair with somebody, but was dating Robert Pattinson at the time.
Yeah, I was reading she was dating Robert Pattinson at the time.
But she had an affair with
Taylor Lautner.
Somebody. No. It was like an older guy. It was a director, maybe.
Chris Hemsworth.
No.
Rupert Sanders.
Oh, here we go. Who did Kristen Stewart cheat on Robert Pattinson with?
Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, no, wait. It was Rupert Sanders.
It was?
Yeah.
Holy shit. Well, that's okay. That's a little different because he's directed this movie.
Yeah.
That's a whole different scandal, though.
Yeah. No, she, so she got with him, I guess, while they were filming this movie. And then, like, came out. And then a lot of people who had, like, previously been on her side were no longer on her side.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I remember that whole debacle quite well.
Yeah. And then finally, our king, Roger Ebert, gave the film 3.5 out of 4 stars and said, quote, Snow White and the Huntsman reinvents the legendary story in a film of astonishing beauty and imagination. It's the last thing you would expect from a picture with this title. It falters in its storytelling because Snow White must be entirely good, the queen must be entirely bad, and there's no room for nuance. The end is therefore predetermined, but oh, what a ride. He concluded, there is a great film here somewhere, perhaps one that allowed greater complexity for the characters, but considering that I walked in expecting no complexity at all, let alone the visual wonderments, Snow White and the Huntsman is a considerable experience, end quote. So Roger Ebert thought a little bit, left a little bit to be desired in terms of some of the characters and what's going on there, but overall thought it was a very good movie that had a lot of potential. So,
I mean, 3.5 out of 4 is not bad.
Yeah, that's really good. I mean, he must have really liked it visually and all the other elements. Because that one part in the middle is a pretty, like, it falters in its storytelling. Snow White must be entirely good, blah, blah, blah. There's no room for nuance, therefore the end is predetermined. Like, that's a pretty big indictment of kind of the core of...
Right.
The story. So the fact that he still gave it 3.5 out of 4 means he liked everything else so much that it made up for, you know, that. So as always, you can do us a favor by heading over to Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Goodreads, any of those places. We'd love to hear from you, hear what you have to say on our next prequel episode about Snow White and the Huntsman. You can also do us a favor by heading over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to our show. Write us a nice little review. Drop us a rating. We would really appreciate that. And you can support us at patreon.com/thisfilmislit. If you want to hear us talk about Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, that is where you will hear. That's where you will hear that. At $5 a month, we release our bonus episodes, and that's what this month's episode is. So look out for that. Katie, where can people watch Snow White and the Huntsman?
Well, as always, you can check with your local library, or if you still have a local video rental store, you can check with them. Otherwise, I did not find this streaming with a subscription anywhere. Really? Yeah. But you can rent it for around $4 through Prime, Apple TV, YouTube, Fandango at Home, or FlixFling, whatever that is.
FlixFling. Amazing. I'm very excited for this now. I wasn't initially, and then, like, I didn't really care what won the bracket because I didn't have strong feelings about any of them. I've seen Disney's Snow White, like, when I was a little kid and not since then, so I don't remember anything about it, but I've never seen any of the other ones. And this one, after having read about it, like I said, especially the cinematographer and just the script being like so kind of well regarded, and it got like some critics really liked it. Mm-hmm. Like it had the mixed reviews, and obviously overall, like the Rotten Tomatoes score was like bad. It was like 48%, but you know, some pretty big critics were pretty enamored with it. Which made me very excited to see, because I'm wondering if this is going to be one of those that maybe is like kind of an obviously tons of people saw it, but I don't feel like it has a huge cultural impact. It's not a movie you hear about a lot. And I wonder if maybe this is a little bit of an underappreciated gem. Hmm. Maybe not. But we'll see. Because I also do wonder how much, like I said, that final review from that one guy that's just dripping with sexism and hatred for Kristen Stewart.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that would color.
Oh,
so much of the critical reviews at the time,
in
like
2012?
Just people's inability to look past the fact that Kristen Stewart is in this movie, which we've gotten past that point now where people can watch movies of Kristen Stewart and be normal about it, which is nice. I do wonder how much of like the fact that it has a 48% on Rotten Tomatoes is just a bunch of people being like, fucking Kristen, look at how dumb, like just internalized misogyny that they don't even realize they're doing. Like, because it is that was rampant. Especially for her at this time period. It was her turn to be the woman we all hated.
Mm.
Not we all, but, you know, as a society.
Yes.
Yeah.
As a collective. As a internet. Collective.
Yeah, or the royal we. Yeah. Well, come back in 1 week's time, and you'll hear us talk. Well, 1 week's time. Well, a little less than 1 week's time. We're catching back up. We're getting back on schedule. And this one will be on. We'll be good. Come back in about half a week's time and hear our discussion on Snow White and the Huntsman. Until that time, guys, gals, I'm Binary Pals, and everybody else,
keep reading books,
watching movies,
and keep being awesome.